Fever Is Green by Brahms, My Love Is Green, sung as an encore by Nina Stemmer with the pianist Matti Hirvonen at Wigmore Hall. But while the applause continues now this lunchtime, it's on to Broadcasting House.
That lunchtime concert from Wigmore Hall in London was first broadcast live last Monday, and the presenter was Sarah Moore Peach. And you may like to know that in yesterday's Music Matters, there was an interview with Nina Stemmer. And you can catch up with that on the Radio 3 website and listen to it again online. Just gone 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. That means it's time for the Early Music Show with Lucy Skeeping.
Hello. Over the next hour, we're going to be looking at one single work, an opera by the great 18th century composer Christoph Willibald Gluck. You may be familiar with his Orfeo et Euridice, which is often performed and recorded. But the opera we're exploring today, Iphigenie en Tauride, has at least an equal claim to being Gluck's finest work. And it not only represents the culmination of his career, but more significantly, a landmark for the important reforms Gluck made to the opera world, which would change the nature of the form forever. So what were these reforms? Well, as Gluck saw it, opera was well due for a serious overhaul. For some time, he'd been concerned about the fundamental problems of its form and content. Stylized and unnatural, both of the main Italian operatic genres had strayed too far from what he felt opera should really be. Opera buffa, the lightweight musical comedies, had long lost their original freshness. The jokes were threadbare and the same weary old stage stereotypes entered and exits, doing the same predictable things and the same familiar plots. As for the more highbrow opera seria, well, it was full of superficial effects and artifice, and the content so boring, so old hat, that it was hard to feel really involved in what was going on at all. As for the singers, in both genres, they just seemed to be there to show off their technique, decorating the vocal lines so floridly that audiences could barely recognise, let alone follow, the original melody. So it was time for a change. Gluck was determined to return opera to its origins, focusing on real human drama and passion, and making both words and music of equal importance. He had by now already had considerable success with opera commissions from the great, the good and the blue-blooded of Europe, sung by some of the starriest singers of the day. By the 1750s he was in Vienna, Kapellmeister to the Habsburg court, and it was here that he began to think hard about his reforms. With a series of radical new works, Orfeo among them, he gradually began to break the stranglehold of the Italian opera tradition, which had been in place for most of the century. From now on, however famous and diva-like the singers were, the drama was to be more important, and there would be no more dry recitative to hold up the action. In other words, for the first time, opera was going to be all about the plot. In 1773, keen to spread his innovations to the wider world, Gluck moved to Paris, where, under the patronage of his former music pupil, the ill-fated Marie Antoinette, he immediately set about revolutionising French opera, just as he had the Italian. Iphigenie en Tauride was his fifth opera for the French stage, a commission from the Paris Opera to write a piece based on Euripides' stories about the family of Agamemnon in the aftermath of the Trojan War. And in case your knowledge of these things is a tad rusty, Iphigenie is the daughter of Agamemnon and Clytemnestra. Her father had offered her as a sacrifice to ensure his ship's safe passage to Troy. But at the last moment, a deer was magically put in her place, and the goddess Diana transported her to her temple of Tauris, where Iphigenie is now the high priestess. Gluck's opera has no overture as such, which itself must have seemed very modern, just a short orchestral passage evoking calm before turning into a depiction of a great storm at sea. And we're straight into the action as Iphigenie and her priestesses beg the gods to protect them from the storm.
Thank you.
Great gods, extend to us your aid. Avert your avenging thunderbolts. Let them fall on guilty heads. Innocence dwells in our hearts. The opening of Gluck's opera Iphigénie en Tauride in the recording by Mark Minkowski's Musiciens du Louvre. Iphigénie was sung there by Mireille Delouche. Actually, this was Gluck's second opera based on the life of this Greek heroine. When he arrived in France, his first work for the Paris stage was Iphigénie en Aulide, an opera which sparked a huge controversy, almost a war, with Gluck's opponents even bringing the leading Italian composer Niccolò Piccinini over to Paris to demonstrate just how superior Neapolitan opera was compared with the French. It was said that the whole city got involved, taking sides between the Gluckists and the Piccinists. Needless to say, neither composer took part in the polemics themselves. But what Gluck hadn't realised when he began work on Iphigenia in Tauride was that Piccinini was working on exactly the same project at the same time. No wonder the Italian and his supporters had felt so cut up. In the event, Gluck won the race to the stage, and when Piccinini's opera was finally produced 2 years later, it was a total flop. I guess all that could have made a pretty dramatic opera plot itself. But let's turn now to the story of the mythical Iphigénie, the subject of our programme. The storm has died down, but our heroine remains troubled by a dream, or rather a nightmare, in which she saw her mother, Clytemnestra, murdering her father, Agamemnon, then her brother, Orestes, killing their mother, and finally her own hand stabbing her brother. She prays to the goddess Diana to reunite her with Orestes. Thoas, the king of Tauride, now shows up, and he too is obsessed with dark thoughts. There's a custom among the Scythians who inhabit Tauride to ritually sacrifice any foreigners who are shipwrecked on their shores. And he tells Iphigénie that the oracles predict doom for him if a single stranger escapes with his life. Musically, part of Gluck's reforms included a revolution when it came to the recitatives. Previously, these had been used as plot-driving material, simply accompanied by just a harpsichord or cello, so they felt different from the sort of full-on arias. But Gluck now provided a complete orchestral accompaniment for them, so there was a sense of seamlessness and the drama could build more effectively. Let's hear one of those more fully accompanied recitatives now, as we rejoin the action the entry of King Thoas. Oh! Susan Graham as Iphigenie and Philippe Rouillon as King Thoas, with Ivor Bolton conducting the Mozarteum Orchestra Salzburg. The entry of King Thoas explaining his dark thoughts of ritual xenophobic sacrifice to the priestess Iphigenie. The plot now takes an even darker turn as a chorus of Scythians arrives with news of two young Greeks who've just been found shipwrecked, and the Scythians are demanding their blood. Iphigenie and her priestesses depart, and King Thoas summons the two young men to ask why they've come. They turn out to be Iphigenia's brother Orestes and his friend Pylades, and although they don't let on, they're actually on a mission to retrieve Diana's statue and return it to Greece. Angered, Thoas promises them death and has them taken away. Unusually for French opera, Iphigenie contains only one short divertissement, the Scythians' Turkish-style chorus and dance at the end of the first act. The lack of other similar interludes of dance and spectacle was so out of the ordinary that after the first five performances, the authorities at the Paris Opera added some ballet music by François Gossec to bulk out the finale. Much to Gluck's annoyance, I suspect. Anyway, this is Gluck's own ballet music now, followed by that final chorus of the Scythians at the end of Act One, as poor Orestes and Pylades are taken away to be prepared for their execution.
Yeah.
John Elliott Gardner conducted the Monteverdi Choir and the Orchestra of the Lyon Opera in the closing ballet and chorus at the end of Act One of Gluck's opera Iphigenie en Tauride. You're listening to the Early Music Show on BBC Radio 3 with me, Lucy Skeeping. Act Two begins in an inner chamber of the Temple of Diana, where Orestes and his friend Pylades languish in chains, awaiting their imminent execution at the hands of the Scythian hordes and, of course, the reluctant King Thoas. Orestes blames himself for his friend's predicament, but Pylades assures him he can face death. At least they will die united. A minister of the sanctuary now comes to remove Pylades. Orestes, half asleep, is tormented by visions of the Furies who wish to avenge his own murdering of his mother, an act of revenge he undertook because she had killed his beloved father, Agamemnon. His aria is an example of one of Gluck's most famous pieces of psychological instrumentation. Left alone, Orestes tries to delude himself that he feels calm and peaceful by singing Le calme rentre dans mon cœur. But the agitated accompaniment with repeated notes and strong rhythmic downbeats tells us, the audience, that beneath the surface he is deeply troubled. This is possibly the first occurrence in any opera of this kind of thing, using the orchestra to reveal inward subconscious feelings that are the opposite of the words the character is actually singing. And it's a practice that Wagner would incorporate into a complete compositional system about 75 years later. Apparently, when a critic complained to Gluck about the contradiction between Orestes' words and the musical accompaniment, the composer simply replied, "He's lying. He killed his mother."
Mais nous on l'a si
the Furies tormenting Orestes in his dream in Act Two of Gluck's opera Iphigenie en Tauride. Simon Keenly's side was Orestes, and the chorus and musicians de Louvre were directed by Mark Minkowski. At the end of the act, Iphigenia enters, and although she and her brother don't recognise each other, Orestes sees an astonishing likeness between her and their mother, the slain Clytemnestra seen in his dream. Iphigenie questions him, asking of the fate of their father Agamemnon and all of Greece. On hearing of her father's murder by her mother and her mother's subsequent murder by her son, she is distraught. What became of the son, she asks. Orestes tells her only that he found the death he had so long sought, and that only their sister Electra remains alive. Iphigenia sends Orestes away, and now, in one of the most beautiful arias in the opera, she and her priestesses lament the destruction of her country and the supposed death of her brother. O malheureuse Iphigenie, O wretched Iphigenia, your country is destroyed, you have no more kings, I have no more kindred.
Thank you.
Diana Montague as Iphigenia, lamenting the supposed death of her brother Orestes at the end of Act Two of Gluck's opera Iphigenia en Tauride. The ladies of the Monteverdi Choir and the orchestra of the Lyon Opera were conducted by Jean Elliot Gardner. Act Three begins in Iphigenia's chamber. She's drawn to the mysterious stranger whom she has yet to realise is her brother Orestes. She tells him and his friend Pylades that she can persuade King Thoas to save one of them from sacrificial death, and that the one who is spared should carry news of her fate to her sister Electra back in Argos. Both men agree, and Iphigenia chooses Orestes to survive. However, once she's left, Orestes insists that he and Pylades switch places. He cannot bear the thought of his friend's death and sees dying as an escape from his own madness. Pylades, though, is glad at the thought of dying if it means Orestes can live. There's a touching pair of duets between the two friends, with one of Gluck's revolutionary accompanied recitatives in the middle. We're going to hear the whole section now with the great Thomas Allen as Orestes. Thomas Allen as Orestes and Gösta Winberg as his friend Pylades in a selfless discussion about which one of them should live and which should die. Part of Act Three in Gluck's opera Iphigenie en Tauride, a 1992 recording at La Scala, Milan, conducted by Riccardo Muti. When Iphigenia returns, her brother Orestes insists that she reverse her decision and threatens to kill himself before her eyes if she doesn't. Reluctantly, she agrees to spare Pylades instead and sends him to carry her message to Electra. As everyone departs, Pylades closes the act alone, promising to do everything possible to save Orestes. At the top of Act Four, the curtain rises to reveal Iphigenia back inside the Temple of Diana, wondering how she can ever carry out the killing of Orestes. Somehow, her soul shrinks from the thought of it. In one of the most famous arias of the whole opera, she asks the goddess Diana to help her steel herself for the task. Je t'implore et je tremble. Trembling, I implore thee, implacable goddess, to set ferocity deep in my heart, to stifle the woeful and pitiable voice of humanity.
Oh,
Ivor Bolton conducted the Salzburg Mozarteum Orchestra with Susan Graham in the title role, trembling and imploring the goddess Diana to give her the strength to kill the stranger, who is really her brother Orestes. Well, we're now well into the fourth and final act of Gluck's opera Iphigenie en Tauride, the subject of today's early music show with me, Lucy Skeeping. It's time for Orestes to meet his final doom at the hands of his sister. The priestesses have prepared him for sacrifice. As they bring him in, he bravely tells Iphigenie not to lament him, but to strike cleanly, for it is the will of the gods. The priestesses sing a hymn to Diana as they lead Orestes to the altar.
Au ciel, baissez-vous que je vois.
Well, it's all hotting up now. Orestes and Iphigenia have at last cottoned on that they are in fact brother and sister, and Diana's priestesses now recognise him as their rightful king. The siblings' happy reunion, however, is cut short by the news that King Thoas is coming. He's heard that one of the captives was released and is intent on the blood of the other. And that was the messenger we heard at the end of the last section in that recording there from Mark Minkowski and the Musiciens du Louvre. Simon Keenly's side was the voice of Orestes and Mireille Delouche was Iphigenie. So how does it all end? Well, King Thoas is not a happy camper. Furious, he orders his guards to seize Orestes and vows to sacrifice both him and his sister. But now, in a big action moment worthy of Errol Flynn, Pylades bursts in with a band of Greeks and they cut down Thoas where he stands. Pandemonium breaks out as the Greeks begin to overpower the Scythians. But, well, this is opera, albeit of the realistic reformed sort. And so, in the nick of time, down from the flies, almost certainly by way of a cranky machine, is lowered none other than the female superhero, the goddess Diana, come to save the day. Diana commands the Scythians to restore her statue to Greece, pardons Orestes for murdering his mother, sends him to claim his rightful throne, and bids him restore Iphigenia to her country. So all's well that ends well, and we'll end the programme with those closing scenes.
Thank you.
the tyrant Thoas is slain, brother and sister Orestes and Iphigenia are reunited, and as the goddess Diana is carried back up into the clouds, presumably by several strong stagehands and a large handle, everyone sings a final chorus of rejoicing at having the favour of earth and heaven restored to them once more. Those were the closing scenes of Gluck's opera Iphigenie en Tauride in the 1985 recording by the Monteverdi Choir and the Orchestra of Lyon Opera conducted by John Elliott Gardner. Iphigenie was sung by Diana Montagu, Orestes by Thomas Allen, King Thoas was René Massy, John Ayler sang the role of Pylades, and the soprano Colette Alliot-Lugath popped up, or should I say popped down, in the last scene to sing the role of Diana. And so ends what turned out to be one of Gluck's most popular Parisian operas. In 1779, it ran for some 35 performances and over the next 50 years went on to enjoy more than 400 productions. Certainly, Gluck considered it to be his finest achievement. In 1781, he brought out a German version of the opera for the visit of the Russian Grand Duke to Vienna. It was the only opera he wrote in his native tongue, and it turned out to be the last work he wrote for the stage. Gluck's legacy of operatic reform not only influenced Mozart and a flourishing school of disciples in Paris, but his ideals were taken up and followed well into the 19th century by the likes of Berlioz, Weber, and of course Wagner, whose concept of music drama was not so very far removed from Gluck's own. Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose.
Today's Early Music Show was presented by Lucy Skeeping and produced in Salford by Les Pratt. BBC Radio 3, it's 3 o'clock. Now live in concert, the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra in Mumbai in India. The broadcast is presented by Petrock Trelawney.
It's been another hot day here in Mumbai, temperatures in the mid-30s. I'm standing at the very southern tip of Nariman Point. In the 1960s, this area was actually under the sea, and then slowly 8 acres of land was reclaimed to create a space for the theatres and concert halls that make up the National Centre for the Performing Arts. It's a pretty spectacular location for a concert hall. It's dark now, but if I look to my right, you can see the lights twinkling around the horseshoe curve of Back Bay, the sands of Chapati Beach in front. Directly ahead of me, the Arabian Sea, and to my left, the tower blocks and the causeway leading to Kalaba, the very southern tip of Mumbai. It's been a typically smoggy day here today, but very much a Sunday feeling. Hundreds of people out now for an evening stroll. The police band were playing earlier on, getting a good crowd to hear them. A group of soldiers standing around a sugarcane stall, and some children on the street just over there playing an impromptu game of cricket. Well, in the concert hall behind me, the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra are about to perform the final concert on what has been a truly groundbreaking tour of India. It started in Chennai, continued to Delhi, and along the way has included education workshops, masterclasses, and family and children's concerts. James McMillan conducting his own work Stomp in a family concert here in Mumbai yesterday morning. What a weekend this is to be in India as the world's largest democracy goes to the polls. Tomorrow morning sees the start of the great spectacle that is the 6-week-long general election. Add to that, right now in Dhaka, India are playing Sri Lanka in the final of the T20 cricket championships. I imagine much of the Indian population are currently glued to their TV screens. We are about to add Mendelssohn, Mozart and Tchaikovsky into the mix. It's just gone 7:30 Indian Standard Time, an evening concert here, a Sunday matinee in the UK. We are live in the Jamshed Baba Theatre here at the National Centre for the Performing Arts, where later Nicola Benedetti will be soloist in Mozart's Turkish Violin Concerto No. 5, and the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra will perform Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony, conducted by James McMillan.
This trip has been a dream come true. I think I speak for all of the members of the orchestra and the students here from the Royal Conservatory that we've had an amazing time. Our minds, our hearts have been opened to a very different culture, and the people we've met have been fantastic. The audiences have been brilliant.
James McMillan, well, those sentiments absolutely echoed by the players of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. Life-changing, a phrase I've heard quite a lot from players over the past couple of days. The best tour ever, many have been saying, and the orchestras, we'll hear later, have been working incredibly hard. British Council, who have been a key partner in this tour, have been helping to coordinate a busy schedule of education projects, masterclasses and schools visits alongside the formal events. Also on the platform today, 13 students from the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland, most of whom seem to have been offered jobs playing in the new Symphony Orchestra of India after they graduate. More on that later. But there's no doubt, I think, that cultural relations between India and Scotland will have stepped up a gear or two by the end of this tour. Well, the players are on stage, a small orchestra to begin, Mendelssohn's Hebrides Overture in just a moment. A little delay, I think, to getting everything absolutely started. Still a few patrons coming into this concert hall. With me all afternoon, all evening here in India, a man who was the BBC's Voice of India for a quarter of a century, who explained this great country to listeners in Britain and broadcast India's news in Hindi to a vast audience here, Sir Mark Tully. Mark, welcome.
Thank you very much, Petrock. It's lovely to be here.
I'm not surprised that this tour has had such an impact on the players, because it is this amazing country which welcomes people with such warmth.
It is a very friendly country, and I'm delighted that the orchestra have had such a good time here. And I do believe that this will really help to introduce more people to Western music here. The audiences have been fantastic. The enthusiasm enormous, and you know, the audience themselves, the orchestra themselves, have told me they've really been touched by the reception they've had here from these audiences.
Well, we'll hear much more from you about the state and the reception of Western classical music in India as our concert progresses. I think 15,000 people is the figure that the BBC Scottish will have performed to by the end of this concert this evening. No surprise that they choose to open their programme with a musical picture of their homeland, Mendelssohn's Hebrides Overture. It was July 1829 that Mendelssohn went first to Edinburgh, visit to Holyrood Palace inspired the Scottish Symphony, which he would finish a dozen years later, then took a trip to Mull in the Inner Hebrides and on to Fingal's Cave, where he scored in his notebook the first 21 bars of his Hebrides Overture. Wonderful musical evocation of the sea, rolling and tossing sea, which, it has to be said, caused Mendelssohn some seasickness on his trip. For Jacqueline Shave, guest leader of the orchestra, she and the players stand as James McMillan takes his position centre stage here in Mumbai to conduct Mendelssohn's Hebrides Overture.